Well, I'm glad that you could all join us for dinner this evening. Thank you. Let's return thanks. Everybody dig in. True story. In an ancient kingdom, there's a vicious, bloody war. It's chaos everywhere. The king is under siege. The crown prince is in the battlefield with him. And the enemy is notorious for its army of assassins. They're slaughtering the king's soldiers. They get to the prince and murder him. They're closing in on the king. And rather than be tortured and killed, he commits suicide. Back at the palace, the wives and children of the royal family are terrified. News reaches them that the king and the prince are both dead, and the killers are on their way. The women and servants grab up as many possessions as they can and scoop up the little children to run for their lives. One of the servants is a nanny. We don't know her name. All we know from history is that she was responsible for the king's grandson, one of the sons of the crown prince, 5 years old. As the alarm sounds, there's panic. People are yelling, running back and forth, and the nanny picks up the boy. Of course, he could walk, but there's no time. But as she flees the palace, she loses her grip on the child. He crashes to the ground. We don't know if she was on a palace stairway or a high place of some sort, but both of the boy's feet are badly damaged. The nanny manages to get him up and get him out. They escape the palace and get out of the city. But the boy never walks again. His name is Mephibosheth. His dead father, Jonathan. His dead grandfather, the king, Saul. And the kingdom hanging in the balance is Israel. It's 1056 BC. By some miracle, the army of assassins, the Philistines, are turned back. But with both the king and the crown prince dead in battle, the kingdom descends into a bloody civil war. The religious leader of Israel, an old prophet named Samuel, has anointed King Saul's son-in-law, David, to be the new king. But Saul has a surviving son, Jonathan's brother, Ishbosheth, who announces that he will be king. Part of the country is under the control of David's army. The rest of the country is under the control of Ishbosheth's army. And young Mephibosheth, the disabled boy, is growing up in the care of his uncle, the king Ishbosheth. But misfortune is following this child. One warm day, King Ishbosheth is taking a nap, and two of his own men slip into his bedroom, stab him in the stomach, and cut off his head. The civil war comes to a sudden end. David is named king over the whole country. But young Mephibosheth, at the age of 12 now, has to flee for his life again. Somehow Mephibosheth, the disabled one, slips out of the country secretly with various servants and friends who are loyal to the house of Saul. Nobody in David's camp even knows he's alive. As Mephibosheth is racing away from trouble, David is heading into it. He can't just march into Jerusalem and take over the country. There's a hitch. Jerusalem, sitting near the border between Ishbosheth's region and David's region, is under the control of a third group, called Jebusites. In order to truly secure control of the nation of Israel, David and his armies will have to go into Jerusalem and defeat the Jebusites, something that has been tried repeatedly down through the years, but never achieved. In fact, the Jebusites are cocky about their invincibility. And even back then, 3,000 years ago, they have something like political propaganda. The Jebusites actually send a message to David that says, "You will not get in here. Even the blind and the lame can ward you off." They're trying to intimidate the Israelite army. But it kind of backfires. David adopts their phrase, "the blind and the lame." He starts referring to the Jebusites not as the Jebusites, but as the blind and the lame. Gets to be kind of a national joke, a catchphrase. Everybody's talking about the blind and the lame. And sure enough, David and his guys run the Jebusites out of Jerusalem. First time in history it's ever been done. Now David solidifies his power and position. He defeats the Philistines. He brings the Ark of the Covenant, the primary symbol of God's relationship with the people, to Jerusalem. He defeats the Moabites. He defeats the Zobahites. He defeats the Arameans who come to help the Zobahites. He defeats the Edomites. All the countries that had threatened Israel are dealt with. Finally, David settles into his palace. Finally, he has rest from all his enemies. Now, I couldn't blame him for kicking back and taking a break. Let the servant girls bring him some grapes and pamper him a little bit. But David doesn't take this approach to the power God has invested in him. God has blessed him, he's honored him, he's given him tremendous resources, and David puts them to work. David asks, "Is there anyone still left in the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness?" David had promised to do this back when he was best friends with Saul's son. Well, now, there was a servant of Saul's household named Ziba. They called him to appear before David, and the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" "Your servant," he replied. So the king asks, "Is there no one still left in the house of Saul to whom I can show God's kindness," or to translate it more literally, "to whom I can show kindness like that of God?" David is not just trying to be a nice guy, well thought of, everybody's favorite king. He wants to show the God type of kindness, the variety of kindness that God shows to human beings. What kind of kindness is that? David proceeds to show us in the rest of verse 3. Ziba answers the king, "Well, there's still a son of Jonathan. He's crippled in both feet." David must have felt a pang when he heard this. He was famous for sneering at the blind and the lame, using disabled people as a symbol of foolishness, using the blind and the lame as a kind of code phrase or shorthand for his enemies. This whole enterprise would have been far easier if Jonathan's son turned out to be a strong and handsome and healthy guy. You know, in the culture of the day, the lame were regarded as kind of an embarrassment. But David pressed on. "Where is he?" the king asks. And Ziba answers, "He's at the house of Machir, son of Amiel, in Lo-Debar." We can skip the geography lesson, but I'll tell you, he's way far from Jerusalem. So King David has him brought from Lo-Debar, from the house of Machir, son of Amiel. What is the God type of kindness? God's thing is proactive kindness. David didn't wait for opportunities to be kind. When God brought an idea, an opportunity for kindness to his mind, he took the initiative. You know, this is what God did for me too. He came looking for me, even when I was running the other direction, hiding out, hoping against hope that there really was no God. He came after me. He found me. He didn't have me brought from Lo-Debar, from the house of Machir, son of Amiel. But he did have me brought from where I was, spiritually crippled, emotionally lame. I'm grateful because I need a God whose kindness is proactive. Well, I can't tell you what went through Mephibosheth's mind when he got the news that King David had summoned him to Jerusalem, but I can imagine his stomach turning flip-flops. Here, he'd avoided death not once but twice. He'd spent almost his entire life hiding out, and now as the last descendant on the losing side of the civil war, he was going to be carried into the new king's palace and most probably executed. So when Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. David said, "Mephibosheth, your servant," he replied. I think David could tell that Mephibosheth was terrified. "Don't be afraid," David said to him, "for I'll surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I'll restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you'll always eat at my table." Mephibosheth bowed down and said, "What is your servant that you should take notice of a dead dog like me?" Which was an eloquent ancient Hebrew way of saying, "With all due respect, Your Highness, this does not make sense." But David didn't care, because he wanted to express kindness like that of God. God's thing is irrational kindness. Doesn't have to make sense. It just is. You know, 1 John 4, 16 is the famous "God is love" verse of the Bible. We've heard this quotation a million times. But the first part of the verse hardly ever gets quoted. This verse begins by saying, "We know and rely on the love God has for us." We need God's love. We couldn't survive without it. And we need for His love for us to be irrational, because if we had to make the case for it, if we had to deserve it, we could never get it. Romans 5:8 says, "God demonstrates His own love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." Not after we got good. Not after we shaped up. Before. David could have said, "Hey, that promise I made to take care of Saul's family, that was a long time ago. This is now. I don't really owe Mephibosheth anything." God could have said, "Hey, Doug Brendel isn't really bringing much to the table. He's busted my design a million times. And he's going to again. I don't really owe Doug Brendel anything." But David's kindness to Mephibosheth was irrational. God's kindness to me was irrational. And I'm grateful, because I need an irrationally kind God. Finally, David demonstrates a third aspect of kindness like that of God. He calls in Ziba, the servant, who had 15 sons and 20 servants of his own, and made him the owner of all the land that Mephibosheth had inherited from Saul. "You farm it," he said, "and build the estate so that you and your family, as well as Mephibosheth, will always be provided for." See, David did not express kindness up to a point and then cut it off. He might have said, "Well, I only met Saul and Jonathan's blood relatives." And he might have said, "Whoa, this is going to be too complicated. I mean, it's not only Mephibosheth, but there's his kid and his servant, and his servant has 15 sons and 20 other servants." He might have said, "Hold it right there. Mephibosheth has a son, and he's not disabled like his father. That makes him a threat to my throne." But David didn't take any of these approaches. He went the opposite direction. He not only expressed kindness, but he went the extra mile to ensure that his kindness would endure, that the blessings he was bringing into Mephibosheth's life would be lasting. David was expressing kindness like that of God. God's kindness is an extra measure kindness. God didn't just do the minimum for me. He didn't just pull my fat out of the eternal fire, although he sure did that. He guaranteed that I would live forever with him. He guaranteed it by sacrificing his own son. We can hardly call that the minimum. It was a tremendous, horrible gift. Who could have blamed him if he had stopped right there? You know, he could have set it up so Jesus was just a fact of history and I could accept his sacrifice and ensure my eternal future, but then I'd be on my own for the rest of my life, living by my own wits, wretched, lonely, worried. But that's not what God did. He didn't stop at Christ's crucifixion. He didn't stop at the resurrection. He went further. He gave me his Spirit as an ongoing gift, a constant companion, supernatural source of comfort and wisdom and power. In John 14, Jesus says, the Spirit will teach me. He'll remind me of what Jesus said and did. He'll give me a sense of peace, and he'll live inside me. He'll live inside me. I won't have to go to some special place to hook up with him. He won't be on a limited schedule, and he'll never, ever leave me. In John 16, Jesus actually says, it's better that he left the earth in his human form, and the Spirit came in as his replacement. It's more expedient, the King James translation says, because Jesus as a human being could only be in one place at a time. But the Spirit can work in the whole world simultaneously. My friend Sharon Collier uses the term separataneously. Separately, but simultaneously. That's how God's Spirit operates. He's doing different kinds of work in different people, but all at the same time. Whatever you needed today, the Spirit of God was there for you. I didn't necessarily need what you needed today. I needed something different. But the Spirit of God was there for me too. This is God's kindness to us in extra measure. He's willing to tromp through life with us, get involved in the details, walk with us and talk with us. It's amazing, really. He's the creator of the whole universe. We're eminently ignorable. And the gift he gave us in the form of his son, Jesus Christ, was more than we ever could have asked for or hoped for, and yet he keeps reaching out to us. So what's my response to God's kindness? How do I express what King David called kindness like that of God? I'm trying to think of the last time I was proactively kind. The last time I specifically looked for a way to express compassion or benevolence or thoughtfulness to somebody. You know, generally I'm so busy, I don't think in terms of proactive kindness. It's all I can do to be kind when the opportunities kind of get in my face. I need God's Spirit to nudge me on this, to bring ideas to mind, to present me with scenarios where I can step into somebody else's life and express kindness like that of God. And how long has it been since I expressed irrational kindness, the kind of response to a person that doesn't quite calculate? A sort of kindness that just goes for it. Maybe it's kindness expressed to somebody who doesn't really deserve it, or somebody who isn't really all that close to me, somebody who I don't really have a long history with. Personally, I think I may do a little better on irrational kindness than I do on proactive kindness. I have a little bit of a reputation with my family and friends for this sort of thing. Some friends were at our house last summer. We grilled burgers and dogs, and we had way too much food, and two guys, Carlos and Domingo, came to the door. They had painted a new house number on our curb, along with a really good-looking little American flag, and they were ready for me to pay them. And I said, aren't you guys hungry? Come in and eat with us. And their faces lit up. Our guests were kind of, whoa, what's up with this? But these two guys had been out working in the hot sun, and they were apparently hungry enough to come in and have some burgers. We talked, we laughed, we ate together. It was fun. It wasn't anything but a small kindness and kind of irrational. And then how do I express extra measure kindness? My nature doesn't really lend itself to extra measure kindness. My nature lends itself to the kindness of convenience. Let's do a nice thing, and then let's let that be enough, okay? Hey, I did my part. Oh, that kind of feeling. I'm too busy, too preoccupied. Whatever is already consuming my attention is too important. But the richest way I can live is to live a life of extra measure kindness, a life that's willing to go the extra mile once in a while. The legacy of Mephibosheth is a legacy of gratitude, of loyalty, of rejoicing in kindness like that of God. He goes down in history as the object of proactive, irrational, extra measure kindness, and a prime example of the impact that God's kindness can make on a person. Who knows what kind of impact I could make tomorrow morning by being proactively kind to someone? Who knows how I might shape a life, maybe for eternity, by being irrationally kind to someone this weekend? Who knows how some extra measure kindness on my part, sometime this week, might rewrite the life story of someone who will cross my path, so that years from now, they'll say, that was the day my life turned a corner. God used that moment to set me in a new direction. I want to be known for kindness like that of God. Will you pray with me? God, help us to be known for the kind of kindness that you showed to us. And let us reflect your proactive, irrational, extra measure kindness to those around us just about every day. Remind us, nudge us, help us to go there. Because God, we know our lives will be richer for it. I thank you. Amen. Back to work.